At 10:30 on the morning of November 15th, 1979, George Meany opened the 13th Constitutional Convention of the AFL-CIO. He was deeply conscious that this was to be his farewell to the labor movement he had led for 25 years, and which he had served valiantly for more than half a century. His words, which he had pondered deeply, must remain as his final testament and legacy to the trade unionists of today and tomorrow. Here, then, is George Meany's keynote address to his last AFL-CIO convention. It is followed by the valedictory remarks of Lane Kirkland, his successor as president of the AFL-CIO, at the Requiem Mass celebrated in St. Matthew's Cathedral, Washington, D.C., on January 16, 1980. On side one of this cassette is the convention tribute to George Meany.
That's enough. Today is the last time I will have the honor of opening a convention of the AFL-CIO. By coincidence, it is also an historic anniversary for the American trade union movement. 98 years ago on this day, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 107 trade unions established the first continuing national trade union center in this country. The AFL-CIO is the direct descendant of that organization. On November 15, 1881, the Federation of Organized Trades and Labor Unions was born for one simple reason. The unions of that day knew, as we know, that in unity there is strength. Of course, there were many trade unions, assemblies, and councils in many cities, even national and international unions, already in existence in 1881. They had already made important gains, but the founders of this great movement knew that much more could be accomplished through a combination of all those organizations. So they organized and adopted a charter to promote the general welfare of the industrial classes and secure that justice which isolated and separated trade and labor unions can never fully command. Each succeeding generation of trade unions has given that charter life and breath. It has been a torch handed down from generation to generation, sometimes flickering, but never dimmed. It is now our responsibility, individually and collectively, to preserve that charter, to give it life and meaning in our time, and to pass it intact and shining to those who follow us, to carry that torch high, with pride and with honor. Despite what some of my friends in the media may believe, I did not attend that convention in 1881. But I have read the proceedings, and I believe Gompers, Foster, Leffingwell, and all of the courageous founders of our movement would look with favor upon the stewardship of their successors. Examine, if you will, their first platform. They determined to fight for compulsory free public education, an end to child labor, achievement of the 8-hour day, protection against garnishment, apprenticeship laws, payment of wages in legal tender, repeal of conspiracy laws, creation of a National Bureau of Labor Statistics, workers' compensation, use of the ballot to elect friendly legislators. The trade union movement has achieved all these and more. With equal vision, succeeding generations have extended the platform. They sought Social Security, unemployment insurance, civil rights, health care for the elderly and the poverty-stricken, minimum wage, occupational health and safety, pensions, a National Labor Relations Act, food stamps, and much, much more. And they achieved those goals as well. And true to our mission to expand the frontiers of human progress, This generation of trade unions has an agenda of platform items as yet unfulfilled. National health insurance, full employment, equal rights for women, labor law reform, to name but a few. And we recognize the constant need to refine and improve and protect those programs already enacted. Labor's agenda and labor's platform are the issues of human concern. Labor's goals are economic and social justice. And because human beings are fallible, achieving those goals requires ever new horizons and commands all of our energy. To achieve those goals, the labor movement cannot be content with defending the status quo or reliving past glories. We must constantly look to the future, develop new leadership, adapt policies to changing conditions and new technologies, but always, always with unswerving loyalty to the mission of the trade union movement as the instrument for improving and enhancing the working and living conditions of those who work for wages. 2 years from today, I expect the AFL-CIO will be celebrating in some form or other the centennial of the American labor movement. Because I know so well the caliber of the leaders of this movement, I am sure that they will not be content to say smugly, "We've come a long way." Rather, I am confident they will use that centennial as a launching pad for new campaigns to improve further the conditions of work and of life in this land. The quest for social and economic justice is never ending. As I leave this office, I am happy and proud to report that the instrument workers created 98 years ago is alive and well and ready to do battle with any foe who would destroy it. It is growing despite the combined effects of technology, unfair international trade policies, and continued high unemployment, which have created particular problems in construction, manufacturing, and transportation, the traditional bases of organized labor. More workers are covered by collective bargaining agreements today than ever before in this nation's history. Despite the fact that the labor laws of this nation have been sharply tilted away from protecting the right of workers to organize and bargain collectively, the movement is growing. Indeed, I am confident that the labor movement is about to embark on another period of significant growth and expansion. The growth in unionization among public workers is continuing at a strong pace, and there are significant organizing breakthroughs by unions in the service trades. White-collar and professional workers are seeking organization. Farm workers are proving their strength against the most oppressive tactics used by any employers anywhere in this nation. The Executive Council report for the past 2 years clearly demonstrates the good health of this federation. Last year in Missouri, we resoundingly defeated the so-called right-to-work referendum, despite an despite a multi-million dollar campaign waged by our enemies, and despite every prediction from every politician at all stripes in Missouri that we couldn't win. Well, we won by 300,000 votes. This year in the Congress, our combined legislative operations blocked every attempt to destroy or weaken the Davis-Bacon Act. Our civil rights efforts have resulted in strengthened and renewed bonds of cooperation with the major minority and women's organizations. Our combined organizing efforts have made major breakthroughs in areas of the country traditionally hostile to unions. Our state federations blocked efforts in state legislatures to force a constitutional convention that would impose a government-busting balanced budget requirement. Every one of our headquarters departments has made continuing provable advancements, and I am proud of the record established by the department directors and their hard-working staffs. Yes, the unity in the Federation itself is unmatched in our history. Without exception, our affiliates are involved in the activities and programs of the Federation. The 24 years of merger have proven once again that in unity there is strength, that all workers share common interests, needs, and expectations, regardless of their craft, the color of the collar they wear, or any other artificial distinction. This federation is the house of labor. It is well built, ready to stand and to shelter workers long beyond the lifetime of everyone in this hall. And there are plenty of rooms in the House of Labor to accommodate all organizations of workers. Today, the American trade union movement is vital, dynamic, growing. It is strong and unified, but it needs to continue to grow, to consolidate its strength, and I predict with certainty that it will. Workers face tough days ahead. The national economy is in a mess. America's energy problems are growing while the oil companies reap outrageous profits. Inflation is unchecked and family budgets are wrecked. The recession is at hand, and in the bellwether housing industry, the depression is already here. Yet the banks raise interest rates to the highest level in the nation's history. The shifting, changing economic policies established by the administration have, without exception, failed because they were ill-advised, ill-considered, ineffective, and inequitable. Obviously, there is need at this time of economic crisis for all elements in society to demonstrate their responsibility. We in the AFL-CIO have already done so. For the national accord recently reached between the administration and the AFL-CIO is a demonstration of labor's willingness to shoulder its share of responsibility on a broad range of national concerns. It is an accord that we would have willingly negotiated with the administration a year ago, but there was no real willingness on the part of the administration to treat us as a concerned partner at that time. We intend to do our share and more to help develop an economic policy that is fair and workable, that divides the burden of sacrifice equally. We have the integrity to live up to our end of the bargain. We also have the courage to blow the whistle if the administration fails to fulfill the obligations it has undertaken. We look for deeds, not rhetoric, programs, not promises. The whole history of this movement is that our word is our bond. We shall keep our word. We expect others to keep theirs. Now the time has come for me to thank you and the members you represent for the highest honor that could be paid any human being, the honor of leading this great organization of workers who have built this nation. It has been both a humbling and a tremendously rewarding experience. It has given me the opportunity of knowing and working with the members of the Executive Council, past and present. Each has made significant contributions to the work of the Federation. Their counsel has been wise, their support outstanding, their friendship rich and warm. The offices of each affiliate and Constitution Department and all of the state and local sentinel bodies have carried out the programs and made this Federation a testament to the foresight of those who gathered in Pittsburgh 98 years ago. To my assistants and to the staff of the Federation, both in the headquarters and in the field, goes my gratitude for a job well done. To you, the delegates to this convention, the representatives of the workers of America, goes my sincere appreciation for this opportunity to serve. And to my God go my prayers. Prayers of thanks for granting me... Let me start that over again. To my God go my prayers. Prayers of thanks for granting me more than one man's share of happiness and rewards. And prayers for his continued blessing on this nation, on this movement, and on each of you. Thank you. Okay, that's it. Thank you very much. The convention will now come to order, and I'd ask Vice President Seidel to take the chair.
The whole earth is the sepulcher of illustrious men. So it was said on such an occasion in a golden age many centuries ago. And so it is now with George Meany. There were no boundaries to his mind and spirit save those of his own constant principles. There is a book here which tells us that wheresoever men are in chains, we are bound with them. George Meany endeavored to live by the full scope of that writ. Strangers did come and try to teach him their ways. Some indeed scorned him just for being what he was. But they came and went, and George Meany abided. Certainly, he was not of the right. Surely, he was not of the left. Nor was he anchored in the center. He stood above such transient categories in resistance to all power directed against the rights of man and woman, and in affirmation of the role and of the interests of plain people. And it is to the honor and the credit of this trade union movement that we clung to his leadership as long as we could, that we kept him as long as the Lord would let us. For he was, to his last day, the best there was. For many years he presided with a gavel and a wooden block made and given him by the Carpenters' Brotherhood. His last light tap of that gavel, before he yielded it, split that old battered block apart, a sign, perhaps, of the honorable completion of his apprenticeship here and of an impending summons to a higher call. That call came 63 years to the day of his admission to membership in the United Association that was his pride. Now he is young and strong again, free of pain, blessed with the rich store of grace, starting over with the steadying and, when needs be, humbling force of Gina at his side. And now we have faith that better days lie ahead for the working people of America and of the world, because George Meany is up there negotiating the matter with God. And now we take our last leave of what remains of him here. Goodbye, George. Fare thee well.